It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to share stories of how culinary arts can affect and reflect the culture of Caribbean islands, how certain recipes encapsulate blended cultures and traditions, flavors and ingredients to tell a story of tragedy and triumph, and how do food traditions help us uncover and retell stories of our past. And I have with me Tamika Francis and I have Susan Turner both. And I'm so excited to have you back on, Tamika, and Susan to have you back on.
Thank you.
Talking about this really neat subject. So welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Excited to be here.
Thank you, Mark. It's awesome.
You're welcome. I love this intersection of culture and, you know, the culinary arts together and ways in which we can learn about people through our food traditions. And so, Tamika, you kind of got me started on this path because you had sent out something that or you were part of a thing that was really talking about two specific islands. But you have a general background across the Caribbean. And so you want to describe for us at least where the location is? I think everybody knows sort of where the Caribbean, but help us get ourselves located.
Let's test my geography. So I'm Tamika Francis. I'm Jamaican born, Jamaican raised, moved to the US in my early 20s. I also lived in St. Lucia for a few years and spent lots of times in Barbados. So the Caribbean is nestled between North America and South America. There are two sets of islands, Leeward and Windward. You know, most folks know the larger islands, and large by either size or by culture. So there's Haiti and the DR that shares a landmass. There's Cuba, there's Puerto Rico, that's American. Jamaica is one of the larger islands. But then dotted along the right side are the Leeward little islands. And they're, when I say tiny, I mean tiny islands. I'm talking about like 100,000 people on some islands, 50,000 on some. So St. Lucia, the Eastern Caribbean, down to Trinidad, that's almost a butting Venezuela on South America. So very diverse in terms of who colonized, who inhabits them. It's French, it's Spanish, it's American, it's Dutch, it's everything.
Yeah, that really helps because I think we don't think of some of the larger islands in there as being part of it. We, in our mind's eye, we think of the littler ones, but it is all across that. And it is that intersection of all those. And you're talking about a lot of different cultures. And so I would think that it has been really influenced by not only where people came from, maybe in slavery to an area, but also where people came from in terms of the enslavers or the country where they were actually, you know, also, you know, trying to get gold or do whatever. So you've got Spanish influence, you've got everything happening in that same thing. So what I really like is that the food traditions must be really diverse.
It's rich. It's super rich. Each island, I think, both carries the history of who it was colonized by, but also we also want to remember the native folks, the indigenous people. So like the Tainos in Puerto Rico were there before the Spanish influence, before the American influence. So there's the homegrown indigenous foods culture, and there's also like that's been imported from elsewhere.
Right, so there was already people living there. That just is also in and of itself exciting to imagine it.
Christopher didn't really discover anywhere.
No, he did not.
There.
he kind of missed everything, including how to treat people. But we'll leave Christopher in his own little world. Susan, I know that you work with Curio Spice, which is really great, and you do the education and stuff. But what I really wanted to have you on here is because you really have a sense of how spices and things really can influence food and culture. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, for me, I mean, that's part of what we look at every day, you know, in our work here at Curio, in terms of where our spices come from and how you use them and the kinds of flavors that you can put together. So there's the whole culinary side, which is always exciting and never ending. There's so much to learn. But for me, I think one of the most fascinating thing is, and it's not just spices, it's culinary traditions in general, is
true.
What a rich brocade of history they contain. And if you just pause and are attuned to them, how much of that story and a sense of discovering that story can be yours just through engaging with those spices. So, for example, one of the things that we carry and we directly source here at Curio is, and this is another part of the world, but is vanilla from Madagascar, which is totally not a native plant to Madagascar. In fact, there are no native pollinators there, so all the pollination happens by hand. But, you know, that we call it, Madagascar vanilla is called bourbon vanilla, and that's because it was brought there by the French. So it refers to that. And it's actually, you know, from Mexico originally. And there's this, like, these grand loops and sweeps. And then I also love how the spices may be brought there, or they may have been, like, allspice, which is native in the Caribbean, exploited by colonizers, it's that those intersections, like the people, the oppressors and the oppressed, the ones who are oppressed actually have in the long run this culinary upper hand, because they take what they retain their own identity, and then they take from the other culture and just say, put it in. And to me, I don't know, it gives me the shivers when I hear stories of that and think of that. It's just such a tribute to human to human experience and human being intrepid. So I love that aspect, the living history of spices.
Yeah. It's so interesting, Mark, just to jump in, when you talk about allspice as an example, even the name, we've talked about this, Susan.
Yeah.
Pimento is the native name, right? And it was the English who called it allspice. For them, I mean, you hold power, so you get to rename things. It tasted like all the spices, so nutmeg and clove and all the notes. So even that misnomer of what the name is, as you were rightfully speaking to, those who held power and had access gets to name a native plant. So that continues to live on as, okay, pimento, allspice, same thing, but the English decided to call it allspice. That made more sense for them.
Naming in itself is that's a whole other show in terms of power dynamics and the history revealed.
Right. Who gets to name in the dominant culture is always interesting. The other thing that I think is amazing about all that, though, is that when we use that word discovery sometimes, that's a real misnomer as well. In other words, there were people there, so nobody really discovered them. That spice was there. Nobody really discovered it. Somebody did. I mean, as an indigenous person, somebody probably did originally. But what I mean is that it is really funny not only renaming it, but thinking that it was an original discovery. And they get kudos for, you know, going somewhere.
Instead of just having the humility to say, this is new to me. How wonderful, you know, it has to be like, it didn't exist before it was named. But like I said, that's a whole,
and instead of self, it's a whole other thing. Tamika, I know that the two things that are really powerful to help us keep culture, one is the stories. mm-hmm. of our culture and by telling those. And then the other is having food traditions that can help us, you know, also tell stories. So I'm interested first in the storytelling part. What are the kinds of stories that would come out of the Caribbean that would be really about food and culture? And I'll let you start there.
Yeah. As you're asking that question, I think one of my first memories of storytelling and food connection, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Ashanti spider, a mythical spider called Anansi. Mm-hmm. Right. So Ghanaian, my family has a lineage, the Ghanaian tribe, Ashanti people. And Anansi was this mythical spider who was very cheeky. And one of the first stories I remember was how he ate somebody's food too quickly and it burned his mouth. And I think the point of the story was not to steal or take people's food, like somewhere there. But as a child, right, using a mythical spider who we all loved, and if he did the right thing, we do the right thing, right? And so stories have always been a way to bring in morale and ethics and also to teach, I think, guidelines on behavior, but also to tell food stories or recipes. Earlier I was talking to another colleague, and we're talking about how very many non-Western cultures in particular didn't write their recipes. They were passed on through oral tradition. So we do the same things and no one really think about why you do it, but you saw it somewhere, you heard it somewhere, and you kind of ingested it. So you taste food in the back of your hand. It's not written anywhere, a recipe to taste food in the back of your hand, but somebody somewhere did that and it passes on. So I think stories, both literal storytelling, but also just watching lived experiences and behaviors and customs is another way that oral history is passed on. But just by essence of eating, I think consuming foods, as a new mom, I am very conscious of like the foods I make at home. There are very many Jamaican foods that I tend not to make very often. I keep asking myself, like, will my son ever get to see this? Like, I saw it growing up. I am like a metropolitan mom. So I'm not making the same things. I'm very conscious of what food stories or food experiences he will have in the home that he will carry on. So it's both the practice, but also I talk about things and I explain things to him. So it's two things. Practice is also speaking.
That's I know, Susan, that you guys really try not only to be the purveyor of something that's culinary, but you also try to get the story as well. Yeah. And so I'll ask you the same kind of question. What stories come to your mind?
Well, my tradition isn't Caribbean at all.
Fine. I mean,
the closest I came was a little sojourn in the Dutch Antilles with my family when I was in junior high school. My dad went down to work in a small hospital to relieve somebody for a few weeks. And so that was a nice behind the scenes way to visit the Antilles. But my food traditions have Southern roots, and there is a lot of storytelling there. And, you know, as I've dug into it more, you realize that only part of the story was told to me. I do feel a real tradition and connection to those Southern foodways, because there's people involved. You know, they're my grandparents and my great aunts and uncles, and how they did things, and the kinds of gardens that they grew, and all of that. And then the types of typical dishes that were, even though I grew up in Ohio, they were still made their way to our table because my mom and my grandmother. But the part of the story that wasn't told is how strong the African diaspora influenced what we had, like, you know, a mess of beans on the table as a, you know, a pot of beans, and having the pot liquor, as you called it, on cornbread and things like that. Those have really direct African roots, and I had no idea of that growing up.
You know what is, I think that's really great, Susan, because one of the things is, Tamika, I'm used to people that come from a lot of food traditions, they take their spices with them when they have to move somewhere or they go somewhere. I think about immigrants from India, or I think about other places. But Susan, that's interesting. You have that, but I don't think as Americans, we often take our spices with it. You know, I mean, we go somewhere else and it isn't as much of as a part of our culture as it might be in other places. Tamika, you know, how important is it to have, and you were talking about with your child, to have those original tastes?
That's a great question. As Susan was talking about the American South, I recognize I am foreign born. He's American born, so he is African American, right? With Jamaican parents. And so I've been teaching myself Southern food ways on purpose. I've been teaching myself American and African American in particular food ways because I want him to have a connection to this land, which is his homeland. But did I, prior to the last year or so, have very much like experience and knowledge of American food ways? I didn't. It feels very disjointed to me, right? I knew the Southern food ways, I knew native food ways. And so I think through him, I'm now being super conscious of what American food ways look like, whether it's collectively or piecemeal. I'm like teaching myself that. I lived overseas with American expats, and you're right. I tended not to see that carrying of American food ways outside America. So I'm uncovering American food ways. I start in the South because, come on, it's the South, right? That's like the mecca of American food ways. I think I'm learning more about the Midwest, which is not a place I paid attention to before. I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma recently. And again, I'd never thought about Tulsa. And as I'm going to these places, I'm starting to uncover who was there first or who was there, you know, for a very long time and what were the stories they had in those spaces. So I'm new and I'm learning.
I think it's too in America that our the cultural thing of embracing the new and leaving the old behind. So in my family is all the people that left. They kept moving. My forebears are the ones that didn't stay put. They're the ones who, you know, sold everything and went to the next place. And there's a certain kind of that's a different kind of migration than the kind of and I think people just, you know, there's a few things that you hold on for fundamental or they're from home, but we're kind of like all about the new. And so we forget things. I mean, and here's a dumb example, but for example, in European American baking, rose water was very, very, very commonly used in dessert baking, in cakes and cookies and puddings and all of that. Through the 19th century, until vanilla became more, you know, less, it became more available to more people.
I love that.
And that's completely lost. So in the spice shop, when you talk about rosewater, people are interested in it, but they're like, I'm afraid I wouldn't have any way to use that. And it's like, oh, if your great grandmother could hear, you know, your great great grandmother could hear you, you'd have a cake that would use that. We have no memory of that.
And I think I think, Susan, that's right. That the emphasis on new, and it may be because not all of us were immigrants. Obviously, there were people brought here in bondage, but those that immigrated, often the new was where they were going for a new life. They were leaving to get away from maybe persecution, even religious persecution, but the new became important. I know that with indigenous peoples in the United States, I know about the Lummi people that are in Bellingham, Washington. And it's interesting as a part of the culture in art and in culinary art, but it's infused in the buildings. It isn't thought of as a secondary thing, but in most European Americans' homes, hanging art on the wall is ephemeral. I mean, it's there, it makes beauty, but we take it down when we leave. It doesn't have that lasting impact. And so I thought that was interesting that, you know, decoration of a building, or ours are so plain often the same because of that new, and we move for new each time. Tamika, it makes me think really about how wonderful it is that you're trying to preserve that culture for your child, as well as take on some of the new. And that must be, holding your culture must be really fragile. It must be a very fragile thing.
Yes and no, right? I think through him, but I also teach culinary classes to youth. And so I'm seeing American youth of all ages. And when I hear the questions they ask, or when I hear they make reference to their own home, like seeing that in real time has been helping me to kind of think through how his experience might be. Very many of the students I teach are first generation. And so they are what I call bicultural. They're in between two spaces. And so as I'm seeing their stories and seeing their experiences, that really helps. But for me, because I moved to the US as an adult, I think I have a lot of home memories and home information. And I was a somewhat fully formed adult before I moved here. My colleagues who are first generation here, I'll have conversation with them, and they weren't living in the Jamaican or Caribbean landscape. So my experience having lived in the landscape was different from theirs when they're seeing things secondhand. So it brings a different set of eyes, but I think both positions are equally valuable.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think when I wonder about food traditions and where they came from and why they were important to be kept, it really does cause us, I think eating events cause us to, as humans, to tell stories. They spark memories. And why do you think that is? Why do foods cause us to remember other things that are not food related? Any guess?
I think it's because they're just so, it's such an encompassing sensory event.
Okay.
To eat. And for example, you know, aroma or smell, our sense of smell is, you know, has the ability to almost instantaneously and very, reaching very far back in our history to pull up very specific memories of events. And it's the last time you had this meal, it was with, in this setting or with these people. And you bring that forward when you make it again for those same people or for new people. And so I think it's just maybe because it's so basic to our, to human survival. And it also, it's like, it's not just eating, it's sharing, it's all the things, it's many of the things that make us human. It has a very immediate connection to those, you know, the ability to have compassion or to share or to be cheap or extravagant or like, you know, many of the attributes. It's right there on the table.
I agree wholeheartedly, especially on the sensory portion, right? You're seeing, you're touching, you're smelling, you're consuming. I often say if I met a person who doesn't like food, they're just not my people, right? Because it's very rare that a person doesn't have a meal or a memory of a meal that transport them to a good time or a good place. And so I think, again, it's like very basic human, like shared humanity. We all have to eat at some point. Apparently, this is so random, Steve Jobs only ate apples or fruit. He's a fruitarian. I don't know how true that is. But otherwise, people, we have to consume food. So it's our shared humanity. We all eat at some point. And very often in that eating, we get to share of ourselves. My favorite way to dine is family style. Because in the passing of things and the sharing of things, it really allows for to instigate conversation, to have your, you know, your fellow diner ask a question. So I do love family style shared meals as a way to really be a catalyst for conversation and for sharing.
Yeah. And to you have to recognize the person next to you if you're passing them the potatoes. You have to be sure they've got the platter at the very least before you let go.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is why it's so important that we do have those moments together as often as we can, because it does hold us together as a community of individuals. I know a lot of community development people will use a meal, bring people together for a barbecue, or they'll bring them together for something else, a stew that people do. But just to be able to have conversations of not only about the community, but to get them to know one another and to organize. And churches have done it forever, right? I mean, they learned early on in churches that having eating events was a way of building community. So that's really powerful. I've been talking with Tamika Francis and Susan Turner about how certain recipes can encapsulate culture and tradition. And join us for more conversation after this short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of the Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're sharing stories of food traditions with Tamika Francis and Susan Turner. And before we went to the break, I was really thinking in my head about what got this whole conversation going. And it was really some of the things that you've been writing about and doing, Tamika. And one of them that I know about, you had a really nice piece that was on the Edible Boston magazine. And it was about goats and food traditions. Can you tell us a little bit of that story?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. And I want to thank Susan for her help on that piece as well. It was a really good piece to work on. I've had this one mowing campaign, I like to say, to try and promote goat meat consumption. Goat is consumed widely globally. It hasn't quite taken on here in the US, but I was taken aback by that. But two, for me, goat is one of the most sustainable animals you can consume for meat. If eating meat is your thing, right? Goats are good for clearing invasive species. It's a kind of animal, like most animals, that are head to tail dining. So every possible part, including the internal organs, can be consumed. And for me, it's my first, my grandpa, who I mentioned in the story, he'd assign us a goat to work with or to have for the summertime. Quick story, I didn't know that goats graze naturally, and all I had to do was just lead it home. So I used to hold on to my goat's rope. Let's just say I had skin knees and skin elbows because I held on to that goat going down a hill. So I learned responsibility. But that very animal was then slaughtered and cleaned and taken care of and became our meal. So goat for me has always been like a memory of home, of family, of tradition. It's birthday parties, it's weddings, it's funerals, it's a housewarming. Big events called for a goat, big events called for a goat being raised for the event. And for me, it's the subsistence of that. And when I moved to America, it was really hard to find that. Over the years, I found there are projects across the country, like the Vermont Chevron, for example, who works with primarily East African refugees to raise goats. So for me, again, goat is my American story. It's a little bit foreign for some. It's super familiar for others. Delicious, can be found in very many places in lower income neighborhoods, but not so much in the downtown area. So I was really indebted to the Elba Boston folks for being able to share that story of both sustainability, but also a food tradition that's very global. And it's, I think, increasing in prominence here in the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking through that, it's really interesting because when I do think about goat in the United States, the only thing I really actually think about is cheese.
Yeah.
And I have had goat dishes when I go out to eat in certain restaurants, and it's wonderful. It tastes wonderful. But I like your idea of it being tied to sustainability, because in a lot of really poorer countries or regions, it's a much more sustainable food than like we have cattle or the other. It is something that people really can, that probably chickens. It's something that that would be, you know, it doesn't take as long to grow a, you know, a goat as it would be a cow.
And the size and
get it to that, and the size and how much it consumes, and a goat is pretty forgiving about what it will eat, which is the other thing. Right. I mean, so I think that's really fascinating that was that, were goats native part of the Caribbean, or were they brought in from somewhere else? Do we know?
I know they're Nigerian goats. I feel like I don't know this for sure. I probably should know. I know it's one of the first animals that was domesticated.
Okay.
So it feels like African. It feels like West African. I should double check.
It does to me too.
Because they're Nigerian fainting goats. Like, I adore them. They walk around just falling over. So I can double check, but I do think, given they were domesticated about 9,000 years ago, then that would not be the Caribbean. We were still underwater then, trying to figure it out.
Yeah, and fish would have been a big tradition as well.
Yes.
Because that, the local catch.
The goats are, like, I mean, goats are kind of a global, like, they're in South America.
Yeah.
South America.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
I think North America is where we haven't seen lots of goat consumption. I know in the Greek tradition, there is lots of goat, roasted goat, Middle Eastern.
It's a very ancient food, for sure.
Yes. It was roasted on a spit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was even, people even preserved goat's milk by fermentation as well, so that it could travel with them and they didn't have to worry about refrigeration. So I think that is really interesting. So when somebody is, let's say, pick Jamaica, when somebody's from Jamaica, there are certain food traditions, as you were saying, that are a little bit different. When we think of the Caribbean, we think of homogenous Caribbean, but it's really different depending on every island, isn't it?
Oh, you're spot on. So I went to the University of the West Indies, which is the Caribbean's like university, and there are four campuses, so Bahamas, Jamaica, Barbados, and Trinidad. When I lived on campus, again, being Jamaican, I was not very familiar with other islands. As I traveled to other islands, I recognized that what we have in common is that we're surrounded by water and we're Caribbean, right? St. Lucia is French West Indies. St. Lucia was colonized 7 times by the British, 7 times by the French. So their food story has like 7 interchangeable like periods. So very heavy on like a bechamel sauce, like, you know, they have like roux and they have more like a Louisiana French Creole kind of vibe going on. And there's no French influence in Jamaica at all. The Dutch islands, ABC, Aruba, Bonaire, Curacao, again, the Dutch really had a stake in enslavement and plantation, and then that's a very different flavor. But Trinidad, and this, I think, Susan, we worked on this together, doing the Palau for Curio Spice class. Trinidad for me is, don't tell my Jamaican friends, right, is my best spot for food. Trinidad has, it's close to South America, so definitely Latin American influence. It was colonized both the French, the English, the Spanish, so they have lots of history there, but also religiously, lots of Islamic traditions and also Hindu traditions, because there's indentured servants who were Indians. So Trinidad is a Latin American influence with Hindu, Islamic, and Afro. That makes for, and then Indo-Chinese, so Chinese indentured servants as well. Street food in Trinidad will make you want to cry. So rich, so complex, but their location makes it possible because they're the most southern Caribbean island right above Venezuela. So very rich.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's more stable weather, all kinds of things because of where they are in the part of the tropics.
Yeah.
And somewhat protected as well, even from hurricanes. And so we can see why the Caribbean became the landing point for many people coming from Europe.
Yeah, it's a passover, right?
Because it was dangerous to come straight over and go up the coast or go down the coast to South America. You know, so a lot of ships went first and then worked their way up close to the coast rather than trying to come straight in.
Across the Atlantic.
Across the Atlantic, because you're somewhat protected in there.
Post that period, so both post-plantation period, The Caribbean became a refuge for folks who were seeking asylum. So Jamaica has a rich Jewish tradition, right?
Wow.
There's a town called Irish Town, because during the Irish famine, there were Irish folks who came to the Caribbean. Guinness is our number one drank beer. Our first prime minister was Irish descent, right? Because during the Irish famine, we took folks into our island. And we continue to do so right now, both refugees, immigrants, come as you are.
Wow. Wow.
I think that you know, that's really interesting for us to try to wrap ourselves around that. We think of ourselves as having a lot of immigrants, and we do. But I think what you're talking about is many of the common threads there were that most of those came in some sort of indentured servant kind of role. And so many of the people other than the indigenous people were also then harnessed in a really bad way to be, you know, workers for people on plantations and others. But mm-hmm. I never had really thought more in the modern era, but you're right, that those become safe havens for people that have been persecuted somewhere else.
Yeah, we have a decent Syrian and Lebanese population. We definitely have folks of Jewish descent during the right after the Holocaust period. The Irish famine brought a few folks into an area called Irish Town. We're literal, right? So you call the town based on the people, the Irish Town. There's still a Spanish influence, so there's a Spanish town, and places are named literally based on the people who were there. So it makes for, our motto is out of many, one people. It really comes from that out of many kinds of people who came, we are Jamaicans.
Wow. Susan, what's that bring to your mind as you hear these kinds of ideas?
I don't know. There's just an underlying generosity of spirit that, and fortitude in the face of, you know, just going forward and then like opening the doors for others instead of just like closing in and saying, you know, okay, no, this is us. Don't bother us. You know, it's just like, there's just a resilience that's amazing.
It is. And Tamika, it creates, then when we do add the food onto it, then it creates that quality of, you said, of us unifying. And while we have our own, we might add our own little bit to it. Like if I came from, for instance, Portugal, I might bring a little bit of something that was mine. But it's the common way in which each island has a diverse set of food, but it also has a blended food that's common. And I think that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, and you speak of Portuguese, we have a codfish. Salted cod is like a part of our national dish, right? And I'm always fascinated by the story of cod through Portugal, through Massachusetts, and through the Caribbean. There's a strong connection there. The Cape of Cod, right? And the Portuguese and the Caribbean, and codfish is quite popular because, again, in exchange for rum, molasses, and sugar, cod was sent into barrels. Dried salted cod was sent as a cheap source of protein to the Caribbean. So cod comes down, we send rum and molasses back, primarily to Boston, right? Primarily to Boston initially, Boston, Massachusetts. So when I moved to Boston and I found that out, I was like, wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, again, you know, food used as exchange, as source of economy. And that's true, and sometimes exploited for that, but other times it was just absolutely how you could get something else that you didn't have in your diet or that you needed. So what's amazing to me is how much food moves. I guess, you know, I always think about it being one place, but it doesn't. Food is moving around and food traditions are moving everywhere.
Yeah,
always.
So they're an essential part of the people and of the culture. Another question, Tamika, that comes to mind is, when you learn about that, is that passed on to you by relatives or friends? How does one learn the food culture of a particular place?
It's through, I mean, it's lived experience. I can speak for myself. I've always been curious about food. I think I knew I'd end up doing something in food at a pretty early age. I was fascinated by goats being slaughtered. I was fascinated by things going from raw to cooked. Like, I just always was fascinated by that. But the very essence of our culture, street food is very big. You know, here in the US, we tend to, which is rightfully so, there are permits and licenses around like food being done outdoors. On almost every street corner in most islands, you can find food being made. No permits, no processes per se. So there's no way to avoid it, right? You're passing by on the way to school, you're seeing a pot of stew being made. So you almost like pick things up as you're going. And so food is ubiquitous in our culture. It's celebration, it's daily life, it's also on the streets, it's in the schools. So there's almost no way to avoid it and avoid learning about it in some ways or some shape and form.
Do recipes get kept from passed on from family to family or within the community? How does that, I would assume that was by either oral language or by watching somebody, but are there more, are you seeing an increase in people writing down recipes?
Yeah, to answer that question, it goes into socioeconomic divide and class, mm-hmm. so and rural and urban as well. Mm-hmm. I remember the first cookbook was in my house, I was in high school, right? You just cook, you make your food, you know it, you see it, you do it. My counterparts were more affluent, they probably have cookbooks. So I think it's a mix of both based on where you're from. So rural areas, for the most part, you just grow up by doing, you see things happen. If you're a little more affluent in the urban areas, you may have access to more books. But I want to say currently there is like this amazing like push to like collect recipes and write stories. And they're more like homegrown stories and books being written, not just in Jamaica and the Caribbean, but I think also here in America, there are lots more cookbooks from different perspectives being written and being published. I'm really excited for what's happening in the food cookbook industry as well.
You know, Susan, that makes me think about how important it is to not just have a recipe, but to also have a photo. You know, the recipe books that I hate the most are ones that have no pictures of anything. You know, they're like, why would I want that? Because it is that art form, right? Of the picture of it or the drawing of it that just somehow it's so essential. And I know you guys, you spend a lot of time at Curio figuring that out. You can't just put the spice or the recipe out there. You've got to do something more with that.
We had to at first, but now, yeah, we are lucky enough to have a couple people on staff who are very talented with the camera. So because we're such a, I think more than ever, a very visual society, it's, and because we're also introducing people, a lot of the recipes that we generate in-house, we are very careful to say we're not, they're not, necessarily, they're inspired by either flavors or cuisine, but that we're working with those, but that they're not, you know, authentic. That's a very tricky word, I know. So that being the case, it is really nice to have pictures with, and it's one way of inviting people into the experience of using spices and of trying flavors and combinations that would be new to them, that, you know, or outside of their comfort zone or their own culinary history.
So I'm kind of a gadget person. So, you know, I kind of like the stuff that we use to make things across the gamut, right?
Yeah.
But I learned so much, like Tamika, if I am in one of your classes or Susan in one of the ones at Curio, or even some of the photos, and I look and I'm just interested not only in the food, but what it's in or the things that were used to prepare it.
Yeah.
Probably much to my overindulgence in having different gadgets to do different things, probably too much. But in a way, that is also a part of what it's beyond the food. It's what's the right presentation? What's the right vessel for it to be in? What would you say in Jamaica? What are some of the when you present something like for a party or for a celebration, are there any traditions in how that's done, laid out, or the kinds of bowls or, I'm curious about the technology side of that.
Sure. I wanted to go back for a little bit. One of the things I love about Curio is the cookbook kits that Curio curates. Like if you have like the double awesome book by Mei Mei, for example, then you curate a little bit of like five spice or Sichuan. So it feels very approachable. Mm-hmm. I know folks who buy a cookbook and they feel overwhelmed by getting everything all at once. I definitely love that you guys curate a cookbook alongside a series of like starter spices.
Yeah, just so you can get the book and you can kind of dive right in.
Yeah, I love that you guys do that. Oh, and I also picked up the spice wheel that you guys have done. You know, I have culinary language, but I think that spice wheel has really introduced me like earthy and green, you know, so I think I definitely appreciate the work that you guys are doing, not just selling spices, but then doing spice education as well. So that wheel is on my refrigerator and I go to it often.
Oh, that's so nice. I'll have to tell Claire. Yeah.
To get my language right.
Yeah. No.
Mark, you asked about gadgets or vessels. Yeah. I don't know where I was recently. I was talking to someone and one of the first like, so the Dutch pot for me and yet the Dutch oven, right, for me is close to my heart. I have a cobalt, I have three or four cobalt blue ones, heavy cast iron. And that was a pan I saw the most in my childhood, a cast iron, heavy bottom Dutch. We have names for them. There's like round belly. There's like different shapes, different heights. There's a whole, if you go to a street vendor in Jamaica, and most Caribbean islands, there's a whole like inventory of a list of names and kinds and heights. There's one for soup and for stews. And that for me carries a special place. It's a curry pot for the goat. It's a pot for the fried chicken. It's also used for bacon. So bacon oven style isn't very common in rural Jamaica because you wouldn't have an in-home oven. So a Dutch oven allows you to put like coals, charcoals on top, charcoals at the bottom. And it provides this like double paneled heating system. Yeah. Again, the Dutch pot allows for that. So that's a really, really important one. Another important one, which is more, I think like rustic, is a gourd, a calabash, just a gourd that's been dried. And mostly folks who are at the Rastafarian tradition will just pick one, clean it up halfway, it's dried and it's an eaten vessel. So I definitely love like calabash.
It's like a little bowl with a handle on it.
It's a little bowl that's rounded. It doesn't sit very well because there's no surface, but it's really a gourd from a tree that's been dried and cut open and that becomes an eating vessel.
I think that's really, really fun.
Yeah, it is. It's really fun. It's also very sustainable.
Absolutely.
It's almost a bamboo plant.
And, you know, and if it breaks, cracks, or, you know, you get we'll get another gourd. Yeah.
And you compost that one.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations like we're having today. And we hope that you will have some conversations at home about your own food traditions and where did things come from. And we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Tamika Francis and Susan Turner about food traditions. And we were just uncovering this idea of, because I have an interest in the technology, of, you know, the pots and things that are used. But Susan, I know that you have this really passion for the simplicity of something. And how often does a culture really use something that the food is combined? You know, it's more efficient. I think of a stews, and I think they become these comfort things for all of us. You know, wherever we are, I think a big pot of something sometimes is the very best thing that makes me feel happy. What's your experience with that?
Well, certainly just, I think most home cooking, I think one way I remember it is actually from piano lessons. And when I started back as an adult, and I had a very strict Russian piano teacher, and if I would say something like, oh, well, my piano at home, and she'd like, would not let me blame the instrument ever. And her thing was, you know, it's like beautiful food is made in simple kitchens. And that's the thing that you, that you see around the world. You know, here we have such sort of palace-like kitchens are the standard or the dream that everyone has. But really, you know, a couple of burners and a couple of pots, and you can make incredible food. And like you said, just a single pot. Or like when you were talking about the Dutch ovens, I mean, that those were, you know, you're just, those are just a remnant. Those are historical remnant of cooking with fire. To have that, and in, like you're saying, in rural areas, it might still be, and people are sort of rediscovering that. But the fact is, like cast iron, they still make those pots with a tin lid. And you can
right,
cook
and the
them
people
that
still
way.
Like if they go camping or whatever, they'll use those in the more traditional way, because they don't have an oven. Tamika, what are some of the things that you remember, or even that you love to do now, that are that kind of food, or it's just kind of put together and it becomes really important as a part of what you do?
In terms of for tools, I'm still, maybe I'll buy like an electric spice grinder at some point in my life. But for now, I'm a mortar and pestle kind of person.
Yeah.
I like the feeling of the like large seeds or peppercorns being cracked and smelling it. So I definitely love my mortar and pestle. Definitely a Dutch pot. I love working. I make a lot of green plantains, and the way I learned, I'm sure there's a plantain mash thing that you can buy, or you can use the back of a skin. There's so many things, but using the green skin of the plantain that you took the plantain from, and then when you fry it for the twice fried like tostones, you reuse that skin as a vessel to crush that plantain in. So those things came literally from my grandma, my mom. And so I could buy a functional plantain mash, but nah, we reuse the skin. So there are a few things I hold on to, and every time I do it, I know I do it as almost a purposeful, like I'm intentionally keeping this with me. I'm keeping my mortar and pestle. My grandpa used to mash, it's called a sham. So it's like peanut, roasted peanut with sugar. And he'd make us this like confectionery, this candy. And he'd have a mortar and pestle. And we take turns crushing it all day. So I hold on to these practices and these tools as a memory for me of how I came into food and my family.
Yeah, I love how you're describing that. Because,
and I'm doing it.
No. You're physically doing it, which is really, you know, for me, that is a part of it. And I was thinking back, so many of us had to, for the last 2 years, had to exist through COVID. But one of the things that came back was people taking a long time to bake things. You know, they'd been buying things in a, you know, go to a bakery or they'd go things, but they weren't going out. And a lot of people rediscovered the art of what you're just saying of by doing by hand, right? It wasn't in a kit as a box. You just did it by hand.
Yeah. I am seasoning this chicken with my mortar pesto blended spices to go into my air fryer. Right.
Right.
So I'm doing both.
That's right.
I'm not a purist by any means,
no.
But there are some things I hold on to because I guess a sensory, as you said, Susan, it feels good to physically crush my spices when I'm ready for them. There's something for me that feels nostalgic, but also like I can decide how much burst of, you know, spice happens in this meal right now. I'm toasting things before I grind them. There are a few slow methods I still take on.
Yeah. I have two of the cast iron pans I have, and then I have a number of things, but two things that I hold very precious are these cast iron pans, and then I have a green stoneware bowl that belonged to my grandparents and my maternal grandparents who lived with us in their very old age. And so that green bowl, like, and the skillet, actually, many batches of cornbread were mixed in that bowl and baked in that skillet. And just picking them up, it's like just a little way of saying hello to Luther and Blanche.
Yes.
And just embracing them and carrying them with me without, it doesn't feel like sentimental or sad. It's just like a little salute and a little acknowledgement of who I am through their grace. And to me, those things are, they're almost alive. They're almost animated when I look at them. They're just, you know, they have an energy to them that I really, really love. And
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of it too. I honestly think, Tamika, when you were describing the plantains, that it may have imparted flavors that we didn't really, they were subtle. In other words, you probably could get a masher that's a more modern one, but doing it, the plantain, mashing it inside the actual skin probably did impart some things that we don't think about that were subtle, but they were there. So it's beyond, I think, sometimes the experience. I was thinking, Susan, I don't do very well with modern day spice grinders because it's risky, because I can ruin spices so fast because they can turn into this paste that I can't really use in what I was intending to use. I mean, the paste I could use somewhere else, but not for what I was intending. Yeah. But when I'm doing mortar and pestle, I know when to stop, you know? And so I think we have a lot of modern conveniences that don't necessarily make us culinary, you know, the culinary part better. I think we get stuck.
Yeah, and also, like you said, Tamika, when we use these, at least some of the older style tools, when we do things by hand, you are, there's a physicality to it. You're very connected.
Yes.
You have an understanding. You know, it's just like a really good chef. So they don't use the meat thermometer. They, when they cook a steak, they touch it and they can tell by the spring. And by the feel, what temperature it is, not just, I mean, you know, what the doneness is because of how the protein has set or not. And so that connection, doing at least some things by hand, also the cleanup is faster, I have to say.
True. It is. It's hard to get it out of some of the things like the spice grinder. It's hard to clean. You were talking about, and we only have just about a minute or so, but I think what's really great, you were talking about the role of generations and how important that was, that we saw you know, our grandparents or great grandparents doing something. And I become really concerned. Do either of you become concerned as we move more away from that, that we might be losing something in our culture around the world? This is not just here, but as we don't have older people living with us as often.
I it makes me really sad. And I mean, I saw it even in my own generation of, you know, because in my mother's generation, there was a lot of pressure to embrace everything modern. And to me, to run into somebody who didn't grow up cooking, I have to stop to think about how to, you know, invite them into that experience if they're interested in learning to cook.
Yeah.
And it's almost incomprehensible to me that you didn't see that in your everyday life. And yet many people didn't. And I think that's even more common now. And where I feel it's really too bad is in, and it's socioeconomic, but I don't know if you see this, Tamika, and the kids that you're teaching, is that they don't have that direct connection at all. Maybe their parents are always working and don't have time to cook or whatever, but their diet and their culinary tradition, it's like lost in one generation.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, super sad.
I'm considered an old or a geriatric millennial, so I'm on the cusp of millennial. And I mean, we've seen that Gen Z and millennials, they were, for the most part, you know, had conveniences, modern conveniences as takeout or whatever. And so I think there are some folks who are reclaiming that. They're recognizing that I don't have the skill set and they're seeking food experiences. And there are others, there's just no space in their life, the life they live within the parents who are working, two-parent household, there's just no space. I do love doing culinary classes where I try and get a gauge where the youth are in their experience, and not to judge or not to, you know, make pastor, but really offer them an invitation. So maybe canned tomatoes is where they're at, and we start there. And we start there and move on from there. So that's one of the things I pay attention to as I teach classes, like, where does this youth, family or so come to in their food experiences? Are they a from scratch tomato sauce kind of family or a bottle? And what can we do an in-between and then offer some skills about how they may transition later on when they do have time or resources to do so?
That's really great. I want to thank both Tamika Francis and Susan Turner for talking about food traditions and taking us on a little bit of a journey through how culinary arts can really reflect the culture of our people. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.